I am Kenneth Nichols. This is the Great White Steel Experience. Today, we have an interview with Wendy J. Fox, the author of the Press 53 book, The Seven Stages of Anger. I'll introduce you to one of her favorite indie bookstores, The Book Bar in Denver, Colorado. I'll tell you about a book you should buy by a great writer named Aaron Birch. And in Better Know a Buckeye, we'll get to know a little bit more about Allison Davis, a poet whose work is something you really should know about. So sit back, relax, mix yourself up a color teeny, and let the digital ones and zeros fly through the air. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors, right after this. If you attended Thomas Ewan Consolidated High School in Chamberlain, Maine between the years of 1978 and 1980, pay attention. Did you suffer physical and emotional trauma caused by Carrietta White? Were you cut by broken glass when she broke that light bulb in the locker room? Did the school suspend you after she made a false allegation of bullying against you? Was your property damaged when you and High exploded? You may be entitled to compensation. Call 1-800-555-CARRY or visit www.carrywhiteclassaction.com today to arrange a free initial consultation. The partners of Bangor's biggest law firm, Adley, Halleck, and Bissonette, are standing up for you. A number of Mainers have already received out-of-court settlements for their pain and suffering. No amount of money can compensate you for the loss of two pigs or the constant fear that another antisocial terrorist like Carrie White may exist in your community. But we'll get you the money you deserve. No recovery, no fee. That's the Adley, Halleck, and Bissonette guarantee. Call 1-800-555-CARRY or visit www.carrywhiteclassaction.com for your free case evaluation and stand up to the bullies who want to make you feel unsafe in your own school or home. Let us fight for you. All right, we are here with Wendy J. Fox, author of the Press 53 book, The Seven Stages of Anger and Other Stories. Wendy, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
All right. First, could you just kind of give us a little summary of the book, what we'll expect when we pick it up?
Sure. The Seven Stages of Anger is a relatively short collection, but it is 11 stories. Actually, in putting the stories together, I was really trying to find just seven of them. The Seven Stages of Anger is a story in the book. So it's 11 stories. They're all pretty short, and they're all very, I would say, character-driven fiction.
It's interesting that you say that, because the note that I made after reading the first couple stories, literally, that you seem to be a little less interested in plot and more interested into delving into the psychology of the story's narrators.
Yeah, I would say that that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think maybe for some people that might kind of be an aesthetic choice. I like books that are more plot-driven. I enjoy reading them. I think for me, it's just, I wouldn't say I'm not interested in plot, but in the context of these stories, I think I was more interested in what's happening to people in their everyday lives.
And I guess, how would you characterize the people? I found them to be, obviously, they're all a little bit different, but the people are either lower middle class or lower class, and they all have, you know, kind of big problems that they're working through. So a few have made it through, I suppose. But mm-hmm. How would you describe the characters that seem to attract your attention?
That's an interesting question. I think that a lot of the characters that I'm interested in writing about, I mean, these stories are fiction, but I think most writers do draw from people that they know or experiences that they have had. And so for me, you know, I grew up in rural Washington State, and so that's a little bit of a different upbringing than one might have if you grow up in a city. So I think that's where a lot of the stuff comes, feeling close to place, feeling close to people who I might characterize as being working class. And so, you know, I'm interested in the stories of the people around me, even though when they come through on the page, they're fictionalized, but some of them may have what I might call like an emotional truth to them, even if they're not, in terms of actual happenings, true.
Yeah, well, in our emails, we kind of mentioned this, and I think we can solve this problem right here and right now. The conundrum of, I guess, what it means to be characterized as a writer of plays.
Sure.
You seemed a little surprised by the perception of some critics that you're a Western writer or a chronicler of the Pacific Northwest. What is all this about, do we think?
You know, I'm not sure. Some of it is absolutely legitimate, right? Like some of it is just a way to talk about any writer. I mean, people say Southern writers or, you know, Midwest writers. I think that there's also something too where anyone outside of the world of New York publishing is automatically of a different place. So I think that's part of it. And you know, as I mentioned in my emails, I don't mind being called a Western writer. I was just surprised that was the perception.
I guess, yeah, obviously there's no unpleasantness involved. I guess I always just wondered that too, because when I read, you know, Southern stories,
mm-hmm.
It usually just strikes me as, you know, just people, characters.
Right.
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. And, I kind of agree with you. I mean, I guess there's maybe sort of, there might be some traditions that are kind of linked with people of certain geographies. Maybe perhaps if we look at what we call Western writers, a lot of times people are writing a lot about the natural world, or they're writing about a certain type of people. Obviously, there are traditions that come out of the South, like the Southern Gothic. But, you know, I think maybe it's just, sometimes talking about writers, talking about writing itself can be sort of abstract. And so I kind of wonder if it's just a way to put a concrete word to sometimes an abstract concept of who are these people and what are they doing.
Okay, very interesting. I think we solved it.
All right.
We figured it all out.
All right.
I found a lot of your choices very interesting. I like to point out kind of small things that writers can kind of steal.
Sure.
For example, on page 16, in the story Zinc, I love the way that in the very beginning of the story, you replaced the dialogue tag, like the boring dialogue tag, with something more concrete. You have your character Julian. The line reads, "Could we try counseling?" Julian liked solutions. Instead of saying Julian said, Julian thought, you know, something more concrete. Was that a conscious choice on your part?
Yeah, it is, because I think that sometimes dealing with dialogue can be a little bit clunky because of those things. So I'm always in favor of a really simple way, like just asked or said, or, you know, hopefully something like dialogue can do two things at once. So hopefully it can help you understand what, you know, you hear what the character is saying. So that's one thing. And then maybe help move the plot or the story forward a little bit. So that Julian likes solutions, it's a way of making sure that it's clear who's talking, but also telling the reader a little bit more about him in that case.
Yeah, definitely. I contrasted that mentally with the dialogue tags in something like Twilight. You know, you'll have the character say, you know, "I'm angry at you," she said, shouting because she was angry.
Right, right.
Whereas Julian liked solutions kind of packs everything in, and it's efficient. It builds characterization while performing the basic requirement of a dialogue tag.
Right.
Very cool. The on page 43, another really small thing that I noticed that you did a couple times. You have a sentence in Maps of the Americas. The second sentence, you wrote, "She disliked intensely the school."
Mm-hmm.
I found it really interesting to put, and then you did it on the next page, where you put that kind of the clause in the middle of the sentence with the commas. Why didn't you write, "She disliked the school intensely"?
In that case, it's kind of to, well, it's really to do two things. One, it's part of it is about the cadence of the piece. So that's a really short sentence, but I feel like even though my stories are very short, they read kind of slowly. And some of that is because of that type of punctuation. Like, she disliked intensely the school. And then it's also a reason to draw attention to the word intensely. So to make sure that the reader doesn't gloss over it. So in this case, we know how much the character of Melanie really, really does dislike the school.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. In terms of structure, I guess I happen to be kind of a structure type person.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that you like to begin by establishing character and then maybe jump back a little bit. But the big anomaly, as you pointed out, is the title story, The Seven Stages of Anger.
Yeah.
I had thoughts, like really cool thoughts on the structure, you know, about the cool structure. What were you going for? You clearly had goals in mind.
Right, in that particular story, or do you mean... Yeah.
Yeah.
So the title story, that's interesting that you bring it up, because the title story is totally different structurally. So it's written in, it's seven different chunks, and each one of the chunks has a title to it. And that story took me a really, really long time to write. I wrote it over probably, man, I want to say a period of 2 or 3 years. Obviously, that wasn't the only thing that I was working on, but I would come back to it and work on these little sections as they kind of formed. So the structure of that story, the reason that it's done in those sections is because, you know, I had these images and these kind of fragmented ideas that I was trying to link together, but they didn't link together in any sort of linear narrative at all. So I used blocking them off in those different title sections as a way to tie it together without having to thread each one of these disparate ideas. And so I think it works in that story. I'm not sure that it would work in something that's like 50 pages long, but for a couple page story, it seemed to be effective.
Yeah, it felt like a lyric essay in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed, I don't know exactly if you were contriving it in that way. I loved that you had, depending on the order, depending on the section, a bit of characterization and or narrative. And then at least one paragraph describing a scientific concept or factual information about topaz.
Right.
And so on. I liked the juxtaposition of the human narrative, which is always inherently subjective, and then scientific information, which by definition, you know, pretty much isn't.
Right. Right. Very yeah. Cool. Yeah. And that's part of the reason why this took me so long to write. One, because it was a super fragmented idea. But two, in trying to pair these ideas of, you know, a character thing with the little scientific chunks, it was really hard for it not to be to read in just a completely random way. So it took me a while to do those ties in a way that seemed meaningful.
Well, how did you decide what to use? Because you used neon, lamb's wool, peacock, topaz, carbon, tongue, and chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide which there's, you know, birds, gems.
Right.
How did you decide what to use?
I feel like when I was first thinking of this, I was thinking something like, oh, okay, animal, vegetable, mineral. And it started that way. And then, so I think a lot of writers do this is, you know, writers just read little chunks of information that is not always connected to anything. And so I believe the first one that I wrote actually was the first one that's in there that's neon. And, you know, I thought this idea of gases, like noble gases that are inert, was really, really interesting because they sort of exist in this way that there's nothing happening. They can't do much until they have something else. Like, obviously, I'm not a scientist. You can hear by the way I'm talking about it. But, you know, when they connect with something else, then they can do their thing. Like in the case of neon, they can glow. And I felt like that was sort of an interesting concept and kind of similar to how humans are sometimes when you're just your isolated self. You know, maybe when you're not interacting with the world that much, you sort of feel like, oh, I'm just me, I'm here. But then you have some sort of interaction and sort of the texture of your world around you changes. And so those are kind of tenuously linked, but it's just sort of that conceptualization of just drawing those comparisons.
I guess I'll just describe what I'm thinking because it always helps to hear what other writers are thinking, but I love the idea of neon, a noble gas, because, you know, I'm exposing my own scientific lack of knowledge, but if I recall from 11th grade AP physics, they have 8 valence electrons, which means that they can't let any more in, and that's kind of like a person, and when we don't allow people in, we have that full shell around us, in this case electrons. I just love that idea for a character or some kind of image or something. So everybody out there can steal that concept as well, just to, you know, borrow it. Take off from that idea.
Yeah, see, I did not know the thing about the electrons, but I love that.
I'm probably wrong, but I do remember that. The valence electron thing. I got a 3, I think, on the AP. 3 out of 5. That was pretty cool. I was not surprised, but I double-checked to make sure, because I didn't want to sound dumb. But I was interested to see that the protagonist of Even After Fire, the Daylight Comes is a young woman named Jenny. And then she comes back in the car.
Yeah.
You see her a little bit later on in life. And what I found interesting was that the car is a little bit, it becomes more of Brian's story.
Mm-hmm.
Are these characters and situations from the, you mentioned you were working on a novel and some of these stories are extracts.
Yeah. And so those two characters, yes, they are part of a novel that I'm working on. As stories in the 7 stages of anger, these sections are actually fairly different than how they exist right now as part of a larger work. But yes, to answer your question, they are 2 reoccurring characters. And so in that larger work, things are told in perspectives. So you do get Brian's perspective and you get Jenny's perspective and you get a number of different perspectives.
Yeah, like a lot of the characters in the book, I do feel a lot of inertness from the characters, people who don't know exactly how to get their lives going.
Mm-hmm.
How did you approach, and this can be a problem for writers, trying to write characters who you know, aren't proactive.
Right.
How do you approach that narratively?
Yeah, that's a challenge because it's that same thing of like when you're writing about someone who's bored, the writing can't be boring. That's ultimately the question. It's the question of plot. Like, what is happening to these people? Why does someone care? And so that's why the camera, if you will, is really kind of close to people's perspective. So even though they may be really struggling to get themselves into gear, you still see that even when someone's in a point of, you know, stasis or feeling very static, like there still is a lot happening with a human, even if it's not outwardly expressed, which is why sometimes we're so close in their heads to give some sort of feeling of momentum, even when someone might be really struggling to figure out what to do.
Very cool. So I'm guessing for you the kind of character or image or situation comes first?
Yeah, I would say that's true. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that my natural tendency goes toward is I like being able to say with my own stories, you know, this is the story in which blank. Or when you read a T.C. Boyle story, you read it and you say, oh, this is the one about, you know, the cloned dog or,
yeah.
You know, there's like a specific thing. And part of my writing journey and reading journey is to, you know, fully appreciate the beauty of not having to shovel entertainment at a reader.
Right.
How do you approach narrative in that way? What's your equivalent to this is the story in which...
Well, I think that something still has to have some sort of narrative center to it. So I do ask that question. So it might not be this is the story in which, you know, the car crash happens. I think of it more... I oftentimes think of stories as kind of like a door. And so I think, well, what is the hinge that this door is hanging on? Because without that hinge, the door is not openable and you just can't approach it. So I look for that same question, but just ask it more in terms of the character themselves. Again, the emotional center. What does everything hinge on or what does it rotate around?
It's interesting because I approach that in terms of, as one of my awesome teachers would point out, Lee K. Abbott, he would point out the stout stake. What are the stakes for the characters in the story?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it's that we're thinking of it in the same way, just differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. I have some kind of standard questions because we never really talk about these things as writers. We never kind of talk about, for example, how do you usually compose your first drafts? Are you a typewriter person? I do my fountain pens. How does that work for you?
I usually do first drafts on a computer. I have always liked to type. My mom used to bring home typewriters for me when I was a kid. I just really liked the action of it. And at this point, I can type a lot faster than I can handwrite. But I still do love the action of handwriting. So a lot of times I will type out first drafts on a computer, and then I print them, and then I edit by hand.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of my first writing experiences was with my dad's electric typewriter. And there's something so satisfying about, you know, the actual tactile sensation of pushing the keys that, you know, we all use computers and we all need them, but you just don't get that as much.
No, you don't. It's not as much action on the keyboard. But I still do like that. And for me, one thing that I actually really like about working on a computer is I'll be working through something in a draft, and then I think, oh, maybe this is not totally going in the right direction. So it's super easy to just do save as, and, you know, maybe you have a couple paragraphs, and then by the time you get to paragraph 3, you say, I want to take this in a different direction, but you can retain all of your other work. Like, you have all of these drafts, and that it's super easy to manage on a computer.
Oh, definitely.
So, I mean, you can do that by hand as well, but just from a practical standpoint, that's something that's helpful for me because I end up, if I'm working through a draft, you know, I'll end up with new story 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 before I get to something.
I title them with like a hook, whatever the hook of the story was to me. I'm trying to think of one. I don't know, adoption story and then the date. So
right.
I remember a little bit about what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of leads into my next question. I'm not a big fan of revision, but you have to do it. Is that what your revision procedure kind of generally looks like? You get a big stack of paper and go at it with a pen?
Yeah, and I am a big fan of revision because I feel like, and obviously everyone's approach is different, but I feel like revision is is really just the chance that I get to have the words do what I want them to do. Like, sometimes you're talking to people and you're like, oh man, I shouldn't have said that. In revision, like, you get to make sure that you never say something that you didn't want to say. And also, I think sometimes for me with revision, maybe I'll sit on a story for a while and then come back to it in 6 months and it reads totally different. And that for me personally can be a great revision opportunity. So usually what I do is try to get through a full draft so I know what I'm working on, and then I will just keep reading through it and reading through it. And a lot of times I read things to myself out loud so that I can check and see if the cadence is correct. And then also reading things out loud, again, for me personally, I find places where, you know, maybe I've repeated a word 5 times, or where a sentence might be grammatically okay, but actually kind of clunks when you're hearing it. So I like that process a lot.
Yeah, no, I've done that. I've read my own novels to myself in a Starbucks, and people look at you like you're a weirdo.
Totally.
Yeah, definitely.
That's okay.
Yeah, and we also never talk about, what's your kind of philosophy in terms of submitting?
Oh, I think submit frequently and often. I mean, I do think that we have a responsibility as writers to, when we submit, make sure that we are submitting our best work. And I also think that, you know, if we're submitting to literary journals, we should be reading literary journals. But, you know, I'm also a believer in submitting a ton all the time, because it takes, you know, journals get so many submissions, and the strength of the work is super important. But sometimes there are other things like timing, or they're seeing a thread of a theme emerge, or they need something that's really short, or they need something that's kind of long if you're talking about a print journal. So there are a lot of factors. So, you know, I haven't counted them recently, but I have a lot of rejections, and I save all of them. And, you know, sometimes you submit to a journal 4 or 5 times, you get 4 or 5 rejections. And then time number 6, they say, yeah, we love this story, let's do it. And that does happen. And, you know, you sometimes can build relationships with editors that way. If they send you a nice note back, I always copy that note and send it with my next submission, so they remember who I am. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. So I think you have to get the work out there, and no one can publish your stories if they don't have a chance to see them, period.
Very cool. Definitely. What's one of your guilty narrative pleasures? Some people like, I like Hell's Kitchen. It's not the greatest thing out there, but what's one of your guilty pleasures?
Oh, you know, in terms of reading, like, I have books that I call like television novels, that they're sort of like watching television. So there's a writer named Leanne Moriarty, who actually, she's a really good writer, but they're these super fast kind of high drama, very emotionally charged quick reads. And they're fun when you just need something to kind of blast through. So I do, you know, sometimes those chick lit books I will totally go for.
I love those. I have no idea why, but I love the you know, as you said, chick lit novels about, you know, a young woman in London working in an ad firm, going out at night. You know, I don't know why, but they're fun, they're quick. I don't know why I enjoy them so much.
Yeah, I mean, it is fun. And I think that's interesting too, because, you know, obviously, you know, I'm in terms of literature, I'm way more interested intellectually in literary fiction, you know, creative nonfiction, even poetry. But there's all types of readers out there, and there's a lot of space for different types of work. And so, you know, if you look at my bookshelves, the chick lit section is not the largest section, but, you know, sometimes it is fun to read through those things. Or the other thing I like too is, are these like popular nonfiction books, like that are kind of like pseudoscientific, well, not pseudoscientific, they're scientific, but they're not hard science. Like, I really enjoyed reading, there's this book called The Longevity Project that is just about different sorts of habits and different types of personalities it's like a longitudinal study that lasted 80 years. You never get into the hard science, but it's a fun read. Those types of things I like a lot.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I would love it if you, to give you the opportunity to give some shout outs to some of your mentors in writing. Who really helped you along the way? Because we all have those people.
Absolutely. I would say the writer Carol Guess helped me a lot. I was in some of her classes as an undergraduate, and I feel like she was one of the first people in my writing life who really pushed and pushed to like revise this. And that helped me, because before that I would write a story and then I would kind of put it away and say, oh, it's done. So that was a really good experience. And then I would also say the writer Gregory Spatz, who I worked with as a graduate student and advised my thesis, he helped me. For someone who is not a super plot-driven person, he really helped me, I think, start to understand how you could do character-driven fiction and not have it just be like internal musings. Like, you don't want it to read like your diary. So both of those people helped me a ton in terms of just applying pressure to the writing that I was already doing and helping me make it better. And very both cool. Fantastic writers in their own right, as well as teachers.
Very cool. And we're nearing the end, but we really do have to know what we should look for next from you.
Well, I hope that the next thing that will be happening is that one of my two novels will find a home. So I have a lot of revising to do, and I have to make some decisions about what I want to do with those. But that is my hope of the next thing.
Whenever people say literary, I always kind of wonder what that literally means.
Sure.
But are they literary fiction or?
I would say literary fiction. Maybe literary fiction. One of them might be literary fiction, sort of verging on popular. I mean, it's kind of hard to characterize it. I totally agree. So right now they're just manuscripts. So that is the hope. And I guess I kind of approach that the same way as, you know, you ask about sending out, and I just think like, well, I can guarantee I'm never going to have a novel if I don't finish it. So I need to kind of get busy.
Very cool. All right. Well, Wendy J. Fox, thank you so much for coming on the show with us. Everybody out there should look for the Press 53 book, The Seven Stages of Anger. You'll find links in the description. You'll find links on the Great Writer's Steel website. So thank you again, and I hope you enjoyed our time together.
Yeah, thank you. This was really fun.
I am the only bookseller. Resistance is futile. Your book buying as it has been is over. From this time forward, you will shop with us for books and garden hoses and cars and aerators for your faucets.
Ladies and gentlemen, Book Bar in Denver, as Wendy J. Fox told me, is exactly what it sounds like. It's a place for people to get together, have a glass of wine, read a book, talk to an author, hear a reading. It's the kind of place that we all need in our communities. And it has free Wi-Fi, which I guess is something that people need. One of the reasons that I get kind of bummed out with the current state of things in our culture is that reading is often seen as something that you do because you're in a class or because you have to. It's not something that you do as a reward to help you make you more human. But that's really what literature does. It helps us understand who we are, our place in the world, and places like Book Bar are very important to a community. Everyone loves their electronic devices, and I certainly love the internet. It's what I'm on right now. However, we need to keep the kind of classic entertainment, the kind of classic relationships that we've had for thousands of years in humanity. Cell phones are great and all, but you don't want to text somebody who just suffered a big loss and say, hey, you know, I'm sorry. It's not the same thing as writing a handwritten note, taking the person out for a cup of coffee, telling them how you feel. We really need to get back to that, and that's the kind of thing that Book Bar is encouraging. I'm recording this in October of 2014, and in that month alone, Book Bar will be hosting a poetry series with Marilyn Crissell and Tom Montag. They'll have literary trivia with Lynn Enger, a poetry reading by John Bream, and a couple of author events and book launch parties. That's what we need. If you are in the Denver area or anywhere close, go ahead and check out Book Bar. You'll find it on 4280 Tennyson Street in Denver, and you can always check out their website. It's very easy to find at bookbardenver.com. Book you should.
Book you should.
Book you should.
Book you should buy. Aaron Birch is the kind of guy that you wish you could be when you grow up. Not only does he do an amazing job editing Hobart, the literary journal, one of my favorites, but he also manages to find time to publish his own work. Over the summer in 2014, Queensferry Press published his book, Backswing. It's a collection of 14 stories. But above all, they're cool stories written by a cool storyteller. The book deserves a lot of attention because the stories are satisfying and the value of the whole is greater than that of its parts. Each story is great, but when you put them all together, they really tickle your brain in a way, the way that you look for when you read good fiction. Writers, you would do well to pick up a copy because Mr. Birch's endless imagination and solid use of craft can help you improve your work. If you're wondering, some of my favorites in the book, I loved Scout, the very first story. I was a big fan of Prestidigitation because in that story, Mr. Birch writes about a magic trick. That is not an easy thing to do. It doesn't transfer to prose very well. Magic tricks are pretty much an inherently visual thing. But Mr. Birch does a wonderful job of helping you understand what's happening, even though you can't see what's going on. So go ahead and pick that book up, Queensferry Press, Backswing, Aaron Birch. You'll find a link in the description. OH! I-O! OH! I-O! Go Bucks! Okay, I'm going to tell you about Allison Davis, but you have to promise not to be jealous. She grew up around Youngstown, Ohio, and she holds an MFA from Ohio State University, of course, making her a Buckeye. But you're going to be jealous because she is a Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford. I know, it makes you jealous, but remember, what's the right thing to do when we're jealous? It's to be happy for somebody and to admire them and try to be like them someday. Her poems have appeared in or are forthcoming in the New Republic, Black Warrior Review, Cut Bank, and many more places. By all means, go ahead and check out her book, Poppy Seeds. It was the winner of the WIC Poetry Chapbook Prize. It's a very cool book, and at least one more of my friends have won that prize. So something you should definitely check out. But most relevant to Great Writer Steel is that Allison Davis was very, very kind. She contributed an essay to Great Writer Steel called How To and How Not To Steal, Writing About Animals. In the essay, which obviously is linked in the description, she examines some of the ethics of writing about animals. Should we use them as pawns, even though they're not real? One of the things I liked most about the essay is that it's about a topic I wouldn't necessarily think of on my own. I guess I've never really thought about the ethical considerations of pretend animals in my pretend works. But it's something that you can consider, and Miss Smith makes a wonderful case, and it's definitely an essay that's worth showing to friends who are writers, or just thinking about for your future work. So remember, that's Allison Davis. Go ahead and pick up her book, Poppy Seeds, from Kent State University Press. And by all means, check out her website at AllisonDavisPoetry.com. She links you to some of her work, and it's definitely worth it because, ladies and gentlemen, it's free. We like free. So what have we learned today? Well, I learned about perseverance because Wendy J. Fox worked very hard for a very long time, and she is seeing the fruits of her labor. Her book is published, and it's a very good one, so go and pick it up. I reminded myself how much I respect Allison Davis and Aaron Birch, very cool, and I restoked my love of bookstores, especially places where it's designed to let you sit and talk to other people. Aren't other people cool most of the time? As you may have guessed, that's all we have for right now. I'm Kenneth Nichols with Great Writer Steel. Remember, Shakespeare did it, so should you.